Well, I wonder if I might interrupt and draw us together. As William said, my name's Nigel Bynum, and can I add my welcome to William's? Very lovely to see everyone here this evening. I hope you've enjoyed your meal and had a nice time around your tables. It'd be a real help to me if you could grab the blue booklets you'll find in the centre of your table. These are copies of John's Gospel, John's eyewitness account of Jesus Christ. And if you could turn to page 28, you'll find yourself in John chapter 9. And we're going to come to that in a few minutes. Let me start by reading a sentence from a very popular book, The Da Vinci Code, which is topping the bestseller charts at the moment. I don't know if you've read it. The main character, Robert, is speaking about why people believe different religions. And he says to Sophie, another main character, Sophie, every faith in the world is based on fabrications. That's the definition of faith. Acceptance of that which we imagine to be true, that which we cannot prove. I read that because it sums up a very common perception of faith or belief today. That it's a matter of persuading ourselves something is true, sort of despite the lack of evidence. In other words, our title tonight, I Have to Stop Thinking to Believe. Well, we're going to look at an incident in John's Gospel which, well, I have to say, completely reverses that idea. We're going to see somebody come to faith, come to believe, but they do so because they start thinking. And we're going to see some people reject Jesus Christ, and they do so because they stop thinking. It's a complete reversal of how we often think today. Quite surprising. I'll be interested to see what you make of it. I've split up what we're going to move our way through the passage. I've split it up under a number of headings. And the first heading is this: the claim and demonstration that Jesus is God's rescuer. The claim and demonstration that Jesus is God's rescuer. Let's read verse 1. John chapter 9, and this is page 28. As he, that's Jesus, passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? The disciples assume that we suffer because of things we do wrong. Jesus says, verse 3, it was not that this man sinned or his parents. It's worth noting, Jesus is clear, suffering is not caused by our particular wrongdoing. So why is he blind? Continuing, but he's blind, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Now when Jesus says, I am the light of the world, he is making an enormous claim about himself. But to really sort of get that and feel that, we have to understand some of the background to that claim. For hundreds of years before Jesus came, God, in the Old Testament, made promises. Promises that he would one day send a rescuer. Now let me read one to you from the prophet Isaiah, where God promises that his rescuer will be, and I quote, a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, and to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. Now the situation here is that God's people are, metaphorically speaking, blind or in the dark. Now we use that sort of language, don't we? We might say someone's in the dark, or you might think of, a clique at work or a college who organise something but leave you out, and you're in the dark. You're kind of blind to what's going on. It means we're kind of cut off, we're excluded. And God is saying here, we are blind or in the dark with him. When it comes to him and us, we are cut off from him. We are excluded. And the reason for that isn't that God's a clique and doesn't want to include us. The reason for that, the Bible is clear, lies in us. We have turned our back on God and haven't lived with him at the centre of our lives as we should. And that means we've ended up cut off from God or in the dark with him. I have to add that the Bible is very clear that is a terrible place to be, whether we realise it or not. It's a terrible place to be cut off from God now, and particularly when we die. Being cut off from God permanently is his judgment, that is his punishment on the fact we have rejected him. Being in the dark is a terrible thing. But God promises through Isaiah, I will send someone who will be a light, and they will bring the blind out of their darkness. In other words, God is promising one day I will send a rescuer who will rescue people from darkness, that is, from being cut off from God, and bring them into the light. And if darkness meant cut off from God, light means knowing God. I will bring people to know God again and live with him and enjoy him. And if darkness was terrible, light is terrific to live with God. Now that's all the background. Thank you for bearing with it. Given all that, Jesus then says, I am the light of the world. He is claiming to be that rescuer that God promised. That's why I said it's an enormous claim. He's saying, left to ourselves we are blind, but that he is the one who can rescue us from that blindness, from that judgment, and bring us to know God and live with God now and forever. He's claiming we need him. We need his rescue. Now, I've gone through that quite fast. I don't know what you think of it. You might be thinking, okay, there's the claim. Why should I believe it? Well, let's read verse 3 again. Why is this man born blind? It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. Jesus is saying that what he's about to do in this blind man is going to display God's work, or demonstrate God to them. And then we read verse 6. Having said these things, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. It's put very simply here, but it's an amazing miracle. Jesus heals a man born blind. And as Jesus says, it demonstrates God's work, or demonstrates who Jesus is. It's a very suitable demonstration, isn't it? He heals a man who is physically in the dark to demonstrate that he is the one who can bring people, who can rescue people who are spiritually in the dark, bring them to know God, out from God's judgment. This miracle is, to put it straightforwardly, is evidence backing up Jesus' claim to be the light of the world. So there, if you like, is the first scene, the claim and demonstration, Jesus is God's rescuer. Let's go on now and see how people react to what has happened. And the next section I've called Opening Our Eyes to Jesus as God's Rescuer. Opening Our Eyes to Jesus. After the miracle, we get a series of conversations with the blind man, or now the not blind man. And I'm going to read what happens. It's quite long, you'll see, actually. It's quite a long chapter. But I hope you find it fascinating to see how it develops. And particularly watch out, as I read through, I'll make some comments as we go, but watch out for how the man's understanding of Jesus Christ changes. Let's start at verse 8. The neighbours and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? Some said, it is he. Others said, no, but he is like him. He kept saying, I am the man. So they said to him, then how were your eyes opened? He answered, the man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received my sight. They said to him, where is he? He said, I do not know. You notice at this stage, Jesus is just the man called Jesus. Let's go from verse 13. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now, it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees again asked him how he received his sight. And he said to them, "He put mud on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath, for he has broken the law that you're not allowed to work." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was division among them. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him since he has opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." As the man thinks about it, he thinks there's something special about Jesus, so he says he's a prophet. Verse 18. The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he's of age, he will speak for himself." And down to verse 24. So for the second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give glory to God," which means tell the truth. "We know that this man is a sinner." He answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that I, though I was blind, now I see." They said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I've told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" And they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." The man answered, "Why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshipper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and would you teach us?" And they cast him out. The blind man realizes Jesus is from God. And then lastly, verse 35, Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" Which is another title for God's rescuer. He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him. In other words, our blind man comes to believe. He comes to faith in Jesus Christ. Now, as we went through, though, did you notice why he believes? Why does he believe? Well, at one level, he comes to believe through what I can only call rational, logical, evidential argument. Now, the evidence of the miracle is clear, isn't it? We get it kind of checked as you go through the story. The identity of the man is checked. The fact he was born blind is checked with his parents. The fact he can now see is obvious, I take it. So it's an undeniable miracle. And from that flows a rational, logical argument. You see it most clearly and succinctly in verse 31, just at the bottom of page 29. This is the blind man, the not blind man, replying. Verse 31, "We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshipper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." The Pharisees are insisting, this Jesus, he's a nobody. And the more they insist, the more the man thinks, and thinks to himself, well, hold on, you say he's a nobody, but he's healed me. And if he healed me, well, only God could heal a man born blind. So this man, he must be from God. He must be God's rescuer. Far from switching off his mind, he comes to believe as he rationally and logically dwells on the evidence. This is faith Not faith despite evidence. This is faith because of evidence. Now, this is such an important point. I wonder if I can try and illustrate it, this nature of faith. Imagine you went on went out mountain walking one day, and you're halfway up the mountain, and suddenly a very dense fog comes down, and you can't see your hand in front of your face. You're trapped. And then you hear a voice shouting to you. It's an old man who's lived in the mountains all his life, knows them like the back of his hand. And he'd seen where you are. If you stay there, you're going to die in the cold. But just to your left is the cliff edge. And about 12 feet down is a ledge, a wide ledge. And if you hang and drop onto that ledge, you can crawl into a cave and you'll be safe there overnight. Well, you crawl to the edge of the, feel the edge, you look over, can't see anything but fog. You dangle down and hang and you sort of dab about with your foot a bit, nothing but air. What are you going to do? Well, you put yourself back up, and let's say you ask the man, you say to the man, you say you know these mountains. Well, as I walked up here this afternoon, the path turns sharply left, what's on the right-hand side? He said, oh, there's a dead tree there. You think, oh, he's right, there was a dead tree. And then you say, well, a bit further on, what happens to the stream on the left? And he says, it turns into a waterfall. And you say, yeah. You question him from your knowledge of the mountain, and he gets everything right. And after a while, you think, he really does know this mountain. And I think I can be sure there is a ledge there and a cave. And so you hang, and then you drop. Now, at that moment, as you drop, you are putting your faith in that ledge. But what I want us to see is you are doing that for good reason. You are putting your faith in something you have become convinced is true, and that you have evidence for. I mean, just to drive it home, let me replay it. Imagine the fog comes down, there's no voice from anybody, you're on your own, you say to yourself, I'm going to die, what shall I do? Here's the edge of the cliff. I wonder if there's a ledge down there with a cave. I've got no reason to believe it. I must just have faith, I must just believe it, and you hang and drop. Now that's not faith, is it? That's madness. When the Bible talks about faith, it's talking about believing something for good reason. And that's what happens to this blind man, this not blind man. He becomes convinced Jesus is God's rescuer as he dwells on the evidence, and then he responds by putting his trust in him for good reason. Now, I don't know what you think of all these things tonight, but I suppose the question I'd like to ask is, have you investigated the evidence for Jesus Christ? Have you investigated, have you looked at his life, for instance, his extraordinary life, his teaching, his miracles like this one here and many more, his fulfillment of the Old Testament promises, his death and his resurrection from death, overcoming death? We run a course here called Christianity Explored. We're going to hear more about it later on. But that is it's a short course, which will be a wonderful way of investigating Jesus Christ, switching on your mind and investigating the evidence and finding out about him. However, having said that much, there is something else going on here. Yes, he dwells on the evidence and comes to faith because of it. But at the same time, we have to say, he believes because Jesus Christ enables him to believe. Have a look at Jesus' own comment on what has happened in verse 39. Page 30. Verse 39. He says, verse 38, Lord, I believe, and he worshipped him. Verse 39, Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Now take the first phrase, that those who do not see, those who are blind, may see. Jesus says, I have come to bring the blind to see. Not just physically see, but spiritually see. That must be the case, actually, from what we've already said. We said at the start, we are blind, cut off from God. And blind people can't just open their own eyes. We need someone to open them for us. In other words, coming to see who Jesus Christ is takes nothing less than a miracle. The miracle of him opening this man's physically blind eyes really is a picture of Jesus opening our eyes spiritually so we see who he is. Now at this point you might want to complain, and I'd understand why. You might want to say, Nigel, you've just been going on for some time trying to tell us it's a rational process. Now you're saying it's a miracle. How can it be both? Well, let me try and illustrate this. I don't know if you remember, I hope it's not a bad memory, of having to go for an eye test at school. You know, you get sort of sat in that funny room you don't normally go to, and you get the big letters, and you go down to the small letters. And then they often hold up something rather like this. I'm sorry if you can't all see this, but it's a circle of sort of reddish-orangish dots with some green dots in the middle, number 5. And they say, what number do you see? And some people say, I can't see a number. I just see dots. Because that's how it is if you're colourblind. You can't distinguish red from green. I hope no one's just discovered they're colourblind. I want to make it clear, I'm not a qualified optician and I take no responsibility, etc. So you probably just can't see it, it's just too far away. Now what if our school pupil couldn't see the number, they're colourblind, and then we found some top neurosurgeon who did an operation and took away their colourblindness somehow. And they then looked at the piece of paper and said, oh, it's number 5, it's obvious. Would we then say, oh, I think that's just a stab in the dark, it's rather irrational? Well, of course not. We would say, they're seeing what was always there. Now, it's the same with us and Jesus, you see. The evidence is there, but we have trouble seeing it. If you like, we are Jesus blind. And we therefore need his help to see clearly and see the evidence. We need him to work a miracle in us. So we can look at the evidence and say, it's obvious. Jesus Christ is God's rescuer and I need him. I used to meet up with a chap who wasn't a Christian and we looked at the Bible together and we came across this issue of being blind. And I said to him at one point, I know you're not ready to become a Christian yet, I realise that, but if this is right, that we are blind and we actually need Jesus' help to see clearly, then why don't you pray, God, please help me see. Please help me look at the evidence and see who Jesus is. Well, he was a humble guy and he was serious about finding the truth and he did pray that prayer. Now, I said a moment ago, will you look at the evidence? And do that. But as you do that, will you realise we don't see straight and we need help? I wonder if you might pray that prayer as well. Well, we talked about opening our eyes to Jesus. There's one other way we can respond, though. And so lastly, and more briefly, let's think about closing our eyes to Jesus. Let me read verse 39 again. This is Jesus' commentary on it. Jesus says, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Jesus says some people get sight from him, other people get blinded by him. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you go on to verse 40, some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said, are we also blind? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains. These people that get blinded, Jesus is talking about those who say we see. That is, they think they have perfect spiritual sight. They think they know what's what with God. And when we look at the rest of the chapter, you find that really does sum up the Pharisees. Let's look at a couple of examples. Verse 16, page 28 at the bottom, verse 16, the man says what Jesus has done. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. They know the Sabbath law said don't work on the Sabbath. Jesus has, so they think they know he's not from God. You get the same in verse 24. For the second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God, we know this man is a sinner. Seem to have slightly prejudged the issue there as they still carry out their investigation. They know the answer. And finally you get verse 34 at the end of the conversation. The man comes to his conclusion, he must be from God. Verse 34, they answered him, you were born in utter sin and would you teach us? And they cast him out. Do you hear the sort of attitude here? We know God said don't work on the Sabbath. Jesus has. We know he's wrong. Don't try and tell us anything different. I remember trying to talk to somebody about Jesus Christ in the past once, and I started, he interrupted me and said, but hold on, look, if there's a God, why did he allow the Holocaust? Now, it's a fair question, it's a good question, it deserves to be considered. But the way he asked it was, don't try and tell me anything. I already know the answer. I know there's not a God. I've got it all sorted. He thought he could see. I don't know if we think we can see. If we do, if we can see on our own, I should say, really, by ourselves, Jesus says we are in danger of becoming blind, which I think he means confirming and deepening our blindness. Again, that's what happens to the Pharisees. As I read the story, I'm sure you saw, they're presented with the evidence, the miracle, but they refuse to believe it. So they search for alternative explanations. They try and sort of refute the facts. And in the end, to be honest, it gets embarrassing. They throw the man out. It's hardly a rational debate, is it? They can't refute the evidence. They can't find another explanation. They can't argue against this man's logic. So they kick him out the door. As they do that, they are confirming they are blind to who Jesus is. I think they're also deepening their blindness. Because as they are shown more and more clearly who Jesus is, they say no to him at a deeper and deeper level. Some of you will know I've got an identical twin brother. For a while we both lived in the same town. We both lived in Cambridge. And one day I was in Sainsbury's shopping, as you do, when, as I went down the aisle, someone smiled at me in a little too friendly a way for a stranger. That's a slightly unnerving experience. And then said hi. I tried to sort of move quickly past, but they sort of blocked my path. And I thought, I'm sure I don't know you. So I said, oh, I'm sorry. You must think I'm Graham. Actually, I'm Nigel, his twin brother. And they said, no, you're having me on. Come on, Graham. It's a sort of funny position to find yourself in. So I said, no, I assure you I'm not. I really am Nigel. Graham really does have a twin brother, and it's me, and I'm not Graham. In the end, they believed me, and we moved on, them embarrassed, etc. Imagine he didn't. Imagine he insisted, no, I know, you're Graham. I call my wife over. This is Nigel, she says. Oh, you're just in on it. I get out my credit cards. you know, Nigel Bynum says, oh, you've had those rigged up. I mean, it would be ridiculous, obviously. But every time I produce more evidence, and he says no to me, it's as though he's becoming kind of more and more entrenched, more and more stubborn, more and more deeply, if you like. And that's what happens to the Pharisees. They see the evidence for Jesus more and more and keep saying no, so they become entrenched in their rejection of him. Jesus says they become more blind. And so he says the last sentence, now that you say we see, your guilt remains. In other words, you're still in the dark, you are cut off from God, and you face his judgment. It's very dangerous to close our eyes to Jesus Christ. Let me sum up, because I must finish. We've seen Jesus claim and demonstrate he is God's rescuer. There are two ways we can react. We can close our eyes to him, reject him, say no. And Jesus says we'll become further and further in the dark facing God's judgment. Or we can open our eyes to Jesus, and I want to urge us to do that. And it will happen as we look at the evidence and think and weigh it up and investigate. And it will happen as we ask Jesus Christ to open our eyes and enable us to see. I'm going to stop. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm going to hand back over to William.
Nigel, thank you very much. As I said earlier, we do love people to ask questions here, and we would love you to do that. You'll find that there are those blue slips just on your table there. I think it would be a help to Nigel if we were able to write out any questions. Thank you very much. Let me say, we have got a pile of questions that we quite simply won't be able to work through this evening. I would have taken a fairly good representative group of questions. I think it's worth my asking you just to reach forward on your table for this little brochure which says Christianity Explored. It might just be worth you looking at that and taking it in your hand for one moment. And allow me to say, this is a really helpful 7-week course. It's not 7 week every night for 7 weeks. It's one night a week over 7 weeks. It's free. We run it here. It's a very similar evening to this evening, except without the kind of waiter service, I'm afraid, and the tablecloth. But in terms of, and it's a shorter presentation of perhaps 10, 15 minutes, and then a chance to ask any question you like around the table. And the thing I love about it is it's a chance to look at the evidence for yourself. So we actually look at one of the eyewitness documents of the eyewitnesses taken from eyewitnesses of the life of Jesus. And it's a chance for us then to look at the evidence for ourselves over the course of 7 weeks. I did it with a friend this time last year, and really it was an excellent opportunity to do that. And then any question you have, you'll have another chance over a slightly more relaxed setting to ask and fire those questions. But for now, we've got Nigel just for a few moments. So, Nigel, the first question, I just thought I'd slip this in. Are the tombs empty, or are there people in them? Good question.
I've asked that question often myself.
Thank you. Now, one which I guess a lot of people, and there were several on this issue of suffering, and I think it is worth just tackling. We can only do it briefly, sadly. Was the tsunami a punishment? If so, that is quite indiscriminate, isn't it?
Yes, thank you. As William said, there's a number of questions on that and questions on people being born blind, understandably. In the Bible's account of our world, it's clear that God made this world perfect, and problems have stemmed from the fact that we have turned our back on God and rejected him. Now, you can see that in a very sort of causal way. We turn our back on God and reject him. I then live as I like. I decide to get drunk, drive, knock someone over. There is terrible suffering caused because of me. Now that's sort of an easy one to understand. Obviously, natural disaster, someone being born blind, that kind of thing, is not accounted in that way. But the Bible says the same answer holds. Our rejection of God as humanity was of such enormity, the whole of creation is affected. And things like natural disasters flow from that act. So that's how it understands those things. Jesus, I'm afraid I can only give quick comments on this. It's such an enormous topic, obviously. But Jesus makes a very striking comment about it when people ask him about some people who have suffered terribly, and he refers to a tower falling on people, a terrible disaster. He says 18 people were killed as a tower fell. Do you think that they were worse offenders than all the others living in Jerusalem? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you all likewise will perish. So Jesus there is clear. These people haven't died and suffered because they were particularly bad, but he takes this suffering as an indication that we are in trouble with God. Because he says, unless you repent, get right with God, you too will perish. So he is saying that these disasters have come from our rejection of God and therefore should be seen as a warning to us. Things aren't right. Things aren't right in our world. Things aren't right with us and God. And we ought to get right with him, is how Jesus takes it. We could talk a lot about Jesus' own suffering. I think that's very important in terms of understanding a God who himself has suffered. And in particular, as we'll say a bit later with some of the other questions, he has suffered to make it possible for us to live with God in a perfect world in the future. So there is an answer to this painful world as well. God is working that out through Jesus Christ. But I'm giving very short answers. William may mention this at the end, but there is a CD available of a variety of talks on various topics, one of which is suffering. As it happens, it's by me. That may be... I'm not trying to promote...
Can I advertise it, Nigel?
Yeah,
there is a CD here. And one of the talks on it is a talk by Nigel on suffering a couple of years ago, and it is a really excellent talk. Now, if you're here as a visitor this evening, we'd love you to take this CD away for nothing. If you're a member of the church family, you can jolly well cough up. But for visitors, we'd love you to take one of these away, and it's CD-ROM, and you can take it away. And there are a number of excellent talks on it, such as a talk on other faiths, such as a talk on suffering, why bother with Christianity, a whole series. You can just scroll through and get the one you want. There it is. You'll find it on your way out. Do please take it away. We'd love you to have that as a resource. Okay, a short answer to a big, big issue, a lot more to think about. The story appears consistent, Nigel, but why should we believe the Bible?
Thank you. Yeah, again, a number of questions on this sort of question of the Bible as evidence and that kind of thing. Take John's Gospel. John is an eyewitness account of Jesus Christ. He was there, he saw Jesus, he heard Jesus, and so he is surely able to tell us the truth about Jesus Christ. That goes for Matthew's Gospel. Mark and Luke are written by people who have spoken to the eyewitnesses. They wrote their accounts, well, obviously, during the lifetime of eyewitnesses, either because they themselves were alive or they spoke to people. I was trying to think of a sort of parallel one could draw. Now, this isn't exact, and it's a bit out of date, unfortunately, but if you could think back to, say, the mid-80s, I don't know if that's possible for you. Probably is for quite a few of us, actually, if that's not too rude a comment. If we could think back to then, could you imagine someone in the 80s writing a history of the Second World War? That's the sort of time gap we're talking about with Jesus' life and death and resurrection and the accounts that are written, roughly speaking. Now, of course, in the 80s, you couldn't just write anything about the Second World War, could you? Because so many people are around who were there, and they'd contradict it and say, no, that didn't happen, and you've got documents and evidence. Now, I know our world in the 20th century is very different to first century Palestine, so the parallel's not exact. But I hope that just gives you a sense of what we're talking about. Eyewitnesses writing a number of years after the event. And so the stuff you can hear about Chinese whispers and myths developing and endless stories being passed down through generations and all getting exaggerated, it's just not true. The Bible is, the New Testament account is written by eyewitnesses or those who spoke to eyewitnesses. The other question, of course, comes up is, do we have what they wrote? They may have written the truth, but have we got a reliable copy of it? and you have to look at the manuscript evidence and that kind of thing, and you find out there is enormous reason to be very confident that we have what they wrote. We have many, many manuscripts. They match up very well. They're from quite an early date. Actually, I was in 2 weeks ago, I was in Manchester, and I saw a sign to the John Rylands Library. And I knew the John Rylands Library has a manuscript, well, a fragment of the New Testament from 120 AD, one of the earliest ones. So in my excitement, I went there and discovered it was nothing but a building site because it's being completely redone. So I couldn't see it. But you can go to the British Library and see, it's called Codex Sinaiticus from 350 AD, a complete copy of the New Testament. There are 5,000 Greek manuscripts. They match up very well, and so we can have great confidence we have what they wrote. Again, much more you could say about that, of course.
And Nigel, worth saying, actually, on that first Christianity Explored evening, or the second one, I think, we give out a sheet which just lays out simply the evidence for the New Testament and the Bible as a historical document. If you would like to look at it for yourself, there's a book, again, on little bookstall as you go out, called The Case for Christ. And again, I read this 2 years ago now. It is really excellent. Really very, very good indeed. On the case for the evidence for the New Testament material being reliable, and also for the resurrection. Well worth a look at. There's another one here, Nigel, which I'll just tackle briefly. I mean, you make the study of the Bible. You do a lot of it. This asks, what about all the contradictory accounts? What do you make when somebody says to you, well, it just keeps on contradicting itself? How do you?
Well, the very tempting reply usually is, because it is quite a common idea, or you hear it around, but the Bible contradicts itself. The most tempting reply is to say, oh, where? Show me. Sometimes the objection evaporates at that point, because it's just an idea that's around, actually, and people don't know. And I think that's largely, I just want to push that and say, I don't think it does. Where are the contradictions? Certainly you get different slants. If four people wrote a different account of an event, you would get different things emphasized and that sort of thing. Certainly people are writing with an agenda, but it doesn't mean they're not writing the truth. So I guess I'll throw the challenge back.
Well, if that is your question, or if you can think of a contradiction you are particularly concerned about, come and grab Nigel. He's just sitting on the table over here. So when we finish, just all myself, I'd love to pick it up with you, what the particular instincts are. Similar with Nigel, I find, you know, the more we find out about the first century and what's going on, you say, oh, well, actually, there's a very simple explanation for that. So, please, can you explain again chapter 9, verse 39 to 41? That's just at the end of the section there. I'm struggling with it, especially those who see may become blind.
Yes, thank you for the question, because it is a slightly tricky one. I tried, but obviously failed to say, and I'm not surprised, I said it quite quickly, that verse 41 gives us the answer to that, I think. The Pharisees in verse 40 say, are we blind, meaning we're not, sure, we can see. And Jesus then says, if you were blind, you'd have no guilt, but now you say we see, your guilt remains. So I think the answer is, when Jesus says those who see, he's talking about people who claim they can see. They think they can see the answer and by themselves know what is what with God. And he says they will become blind because they're not prepared to change, really. I'll give a very quick illustration that tickled me. I heard a thing on the radio before about people who go into bookshops and the funny things they say, and the guy who works in the bookshops talked about people who come in asking for a book and they haven't got the title right, and how funny the exchanges can be. And someone came in once and said, could I have the book about the sergeant's guitar? Oh, I think, madam, you mean Captain Corelli's mandolin. It was that sort of thing. But in this case, she insisted, no, the sergeant's guitar. No, I don't know what happened then. Well, in the end, I think she left the shop, you see, without the book, because she was right. And she wouldn't listen and change her mind. And that is, I think, what Jesus is talking about here. I can see, I know the answer, don't tell me any different, Jesus. People like that will become blind, that is, they become kind of entrenched in their position, and they have to leave the shop without Jesus Christ, effectively, because they won't change.
One or two on miracles. Is a miracle necessarily the manifestation of God? Could there be other explanations if Jesus is just a great healer?
Yes, thank you. It's a very good point, and I would have said more about it if I had time. I think the miracle by itself is not enough. I think that's a fair point and a good point. However, well, for instance, other people in the Bible do miracles but don't claim to be God. So with Jesus Christ, though, I think you put a few different things together. First of all, he does many, many miracles, and they are extraordinary. People cannot refute the evidence here. And you can multiply that many times, and you get really the very strong impression that the hospitals are empty where Jesus is. In fact, a couple of pages on in John's Gospel, you get it's almost funny if it wasn't so sad. The Pharisees say, if you want to turn to it, it's page 35, and verse 47 towards the bottom of the page. This is when Jesus has just raised a man from the dead. Okay, he's been dead 4 days and Jesus raises him. Now that's quite a thing. And the chief priests and the Pharisees, these are Jesus' enemies, gathered the council, verse 47, and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him." I mean, it's crazy logic for a start, isn't it? Sort of, oh, what can we do? The evidence is so great. We've got to... But you see what they're admitting here? The evidence is so great. Everyone will believe in him. Now, if you add to that, he's not just doing power displays and tricks. He's fulfilling the Old Testament. So I mentioned at the start this promise of God sending a rescuer who will open the eyes of the blind. Jesus then comes and fulfills that. And there were some other questions on interpretation we may not have time for. And this helps here because what God has given us is not just kind of bare events, but rather he's given us through history promise and symbol and picture and then fulfillment of it in Jesus Christ. And that gives us a kind of interpretive grid with which to understand what Jesus is doing. So when he says, "I'm the light of the world, I've healed a blind man," we have the context, the background, with which to understand that and make sense of it. And so the question of interpretation is really answered by that, because we have this interpretive grid. I'll stop there, I think.
Somebody's talked to me about the miracles as signposts. What do you think of that, the miracles as signposts?
Yes, that Jesus is, "But I'm the light of the world, I've come to bring people to see God, I'll heal a blind man." That's not, healing blind people isn't what I'm really about, that's not the thing, it's a picture, it's a pointer to who I am, that I'm the one who can bring you to see God. The other thing I think just to add to it is that with all these miracles, Jesus does claim to be God. And explicitly says, "This is evidence I am from God." So if you put all those things together, I think that's very strong evidence.
Thanks. There are a couple of, I think, really excellent... Well, there are a lot of good questions. These, I think, are really excellent ones. The man in the story had a profound personal experience to make him believe and have evidence. If I haven't had that experience, what evidence can I use? And then in 2005, where is the logical evidential argument? The Pharisees struggled to believe 2,000 years ago.
Thank you. Just on the Pharisees struggling to believe, I hope we see that they didn't come out of this well. I mean, they struggled to believe, certainly, but that was their fault. That wasn't the problem with the evidence. Where's the evidence today? Yes, okay, God can perform miracles today, but he doesn't promise to come around healing blind people in our vicinity to prove things to us. So where do we get the evidence? The answer is the Bible. Now, it's of a different sort of evidence, you might say. It's a book. But I think it helps to see that God always intended us to have this as evidence. I think sometimes we think, all this stuff happened back then, and we're here now. Oh, good, so what happened? It so happened someone jotted it down, so we have this. But really, that was where the action was. But when Jesus was doing these things, he said to his followers, "You must record this. You must tell people about me." He effectively kind of set up his spokespeople after him and kind of commissioned the Bible. He says later on in John, he's saying a prayer actually, and he prays for these close followers. They're called the apostles. And when he prays them for a while, and then he says, I do not ask for these only, the apostles, but also for those who will believe in me through their word. So Jesus expects people to come to believe in him through the testimony of these eyewitnesses. And he has arranged that to happen by getting them to write the Bible. He's enabled them to write the Bible so we can have a reliable account today and see the evidence. So we have got the evidence we need, or Jesus thinks we have. He thinks he's given it to us. I'll stop there.
I mean, Nigel, just let me push you on that a bit. You know, from your own personal experience, how do you find that working as contemporary evidence for you?
Well, I find the Bible makes... Well, you could say this because I've decided to believe it, but the Bible does make sense of life, all of life. There's lots of different tests, I guess, you could give to a document or a worldview, but one would be kind of how well it fits with life itself. Does it explain life? How do you explain a world in which there is such good and we're capable of such good and capable of such evil? How do you explain that? Scientific materialism and Richard Dawkins can't explain that. They have to say the good is nothing. I think that's unlivable to say that. It doesn't fit with our experience. The Bible explains it. A good world which has fallen because of our action. And so we are spoiled. The way Jesus teaches, his teaching explains our nature and what we're like. There is a personal fit, if you like, both to the world and, I found, to my life, with what Jesus says. So it rings true at a personal level as well.
Thank you. What did Jesus come to rescue? You talked a certain amount about rescue at the beginning. We've just got a couple of minutes left. What did Jesus come to rescue us from? And how do we know we need rescuing today?
Thank you. Yes, I again said this quickly, so I'm glad for the chance to say it more fully. I mentioned a moment ago, we have turned our back on God, we've rejected God. We were made to live, God made us to live in a relationship with him. He made us out of his love, that we might know him and enjoy him and live being satisfied by him in a relationship. But we have turned our back on God, so I don't want that. And to do that to your creator is the most offensive thing you could ever do. I think that if you accept that the seriousness of your action is proportional to the kind of greatness of the person you do it against, well, we're talking about the creator of the universe, and we've treated him terribly. That is an awful thing to do. And that means we're in trouble with God. So that's what we need rescuing from. God is rightly angry with us, Jesus says. Rightly angry. If he wasn't angry, he would be sort of immoral. He'd just say, well, ignore me, mistreat me, take all my good things, say I don't exist, but it doesn't matter. It would be like saying to the murderer in court, you've murdered these people, it doesn't matter. It would be immoral, wouldn't it? Which is terrible. And that's how it is for God, in the way we treated him. So we are in trouble. And that is why Jesus has come to rescue us.
Thank you. And then this next excellent, we've got one more after this, but why do we need a middleman? Why do we need to believe in Jesus as the only way to access God and salvation? Given that we need rescuing, why is Jesus the middleman?
Thank you. Jesus says there's some questions on other religions as well, which relates to this. Jesus says he is the only one who can rescue us from being in trouble with God. Because he is the only one who has died for us. It's his death. His death is how he rescues us. When Jesus died, he effectively said, I will swap places with you. You are in trouble with God. You have rejected God. I am God's perfect son. I have a relationship with God. Let's swap. And he takes responsibility for all we have done, and so takes God's judgment on all we have done. Which means we can then be forgiven and we can be freed. Actually, no other religion offers that solution. Just about every other religion says, I know this is crude and I don't mean to make too broad a generalization, but it usually says something like, do this, and if you do it enough, whether some moral teaching or religious ritual or something, if you do it enough, you might get to God. But Christianity, Jesus is quite distinct from that. And this is why he claims to be unique and the only way to God, because he says, I have died for you. If the message of religion is do, Jesus' message is done. I've done it for you. I can give you a relationship with God that you could never earn by yourself. And so that is why we need Jesus Christ, because he's died for us. He has stepped in for us to save us.
Nigel, thank you. And the last question then, why should I investigate Jesus' claims now rather than later?
Thank you. Yes. On the mountainside, in the fog, if you don't mind going back there for a moment, you can... Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to sort of play tiddlywinks for a while? Hang out? Look at the fog more closely? I don't know what you'd do sitting in the fog. You would investigate, wouldn't you? You're in trouble. You're in trouble. And so you'd investigate. Not only that, actually, as you would investigate with a certain amount of seriousness, because you can ask your questions to the old man and check it all out, but the clock is ticking, and night is coming, and you're getting cold. So you can't investigate forever. And at some point, you will have to say, I've investigated enough now, and it's time to make a decision. Now, the parallel with Jesus Christ is, he says he's going to come back, and this world will end. Another way of, or we, it may be that first we die. And we just don't know when that is. But the clock is ticking. And so if we are in trouble, surely the first thing we'd do is not wait, we'd investigate. And surely we'd investigate with a certain amount of urgency and say, I've got to investigate because I've got to come to a decision. Because this is really serious. So I'll investigate now.